Where'd you get those shoes? Easy. They're from DSW. Because DSW has the exact right shoes for whatever you're into right now. You know, like the sneakers that make office hours feel like happy hour. The boots that turn grocery aisles into runways. And all the styles that show off the many sides of you, from daydreamer to multitasker and everything in between. Because you do it all in really great shoes. Find a shoe for every you at your DSW store or DSW.com.
Local news can come at you fast. Want the latest on what's happening in your backyard? Download the free Odyssey app. Follow your local news station, and you'll get alerts on the top stories making headlines in your city. You can stay in the know, no matter what you're up to, and be among the first to find out when news breaks. Plus, keep tabs on weather and traffic, so you're never caught off guard. To get started, download the Odyssey app. That's A-U-D-A-C-Y. And follow your local news station.
97.1 FM Talk Podcast.
Our friend Ilya Shapiro is on deck. We'll get to him in just a couple of minutes here. Talk about the birthright citizenship issue. A couple things I wanted to drop in here before that. So BMW announced today, and I think this is in some, ironically, some reaction to the, what did Jennings call the whole thing? Like the salute truther? Yeah. I think that's what he called him, a salute truther. So the whole Elon Musk thing. So BMW announced on X today that they are pulling off of X. They're no longer posting on X. They said, we're no longer posting on X. This is the BMW UK account without providing a reason. Don't worry, though. Our customer support team is still here. If you need us, you can see all the latest news by following us on Facebook and Instagram at BMW UK. So the X users are obviously roasting BMW, talking about their history with Nazi Germany. It just doesn't, you know, I think a lot of celebrities have gotten off of, there's nobody that I follow that's off of X. Mm-mm. I mean, there might be a couple of musician types, but most of the people who were on there before the election are still on there. They really are. Mm. The other story, what was the other one here? Oh, this is good. I posted this on Twitter earlier today. So let me go to my feed because I'm pretty active here on the X, formerly Twitter. You had, well, first of all, Super 70 Sports had a great posting today.
Of course.
I have to mention this, too, because it was actually a retweet of something that they put up in 23. But if you don't follow Super 70 Sports on the X, they had a picture of a Photomat booth. And we love the Photomat. And today's generation will never understand the joy of dropping off film here to let some weird stranger look through all your personal crap before giving you back some pretty crappy photos in an envelope later. It was awesome. I mean, can you imagine that we did that? Just dropped off little rolls of film and some teenager could look through and see what you were taking pictures of. No, our friends at Libs of TikTok, they've been really good at, you know, highlighting some of the nonsense like the new wacko communist superintendent in the Webster Grove School District. But the Webster, this is what people love in Webster, so you get what you deserve. But today they said this. This was earlier today. Meet Julie Scott, a board member for the Wentzville School District. She made a post online comparing President Trump's inauguration to 9/11. After we reached out to the district, fellow board member Renee Henke wrote that she does not endorse the actions of this nature either personally or professionally. So here's what Julie said. Her meme was, I do not feel like I did in 2016. I feel like I did when the plane struck the second tower. We all realized what was happening. So that's what this week is like for her. And somebody had also posted, I'd have to look at this, all these businesses that she apparently had wanted to, and I think she wrote, and I don't know if this is a personal account or the school board account, but she was encouraging people to boycott businesses in Wentzville and in her region if they had supported President Trump. So let's see. I thought I had that list here somewhere. Let me see if I can find it. I don't. But, you know, I don't want to highlight those businesses anyway because we'd want people to go to those. But I thought that that was relatively interesting. The fires are really kicking up out in Los Angeles today. Some new ones. And they had control of one that burned a little closer to Comfort, I think. And they put that one out. But this Ventura County one, which is near Oxnard, has really been burning out of control. I don't know where the winds are. They were really whipping around a few hours ago. Our friend Brian Ping will join us at the bottom of the hour with the very latest. I mean, there's just been a lot of complications. There's more questions about what happened, you know, in the I always forget the names of these fires, but the one near Pasadena,
right?
Altadena. I always want to say Arcadia because that's another place like that, but Altadena. But a lot of these people, I said this earlier, they're looking at the amazing response that these crews have right now, the resources that they have, the water that they have, and they're saying, "Wait a second, what? What about us?
Exactly.
Right? And, you know, Trump's going to go out there, and I would hope that he is going to try to help California, but he's putting conditions down, and he should. You know, until they let water go into the reservoirs, why should the federal taxpayers bail anyone out? So I think conditions will be helpful moving forward. But we'll have an update from Brian Ping plus an audio cut of the day coming up here in just a little bit. But Ilya Shapiro is back with us. He's the director of constitutional studies at the Manhattan Institute. A federal judge today in Seattle blocked the Trump executive order on birthright citizenship. So we're going to talk a little bit about what might happen next. Ilya, how are you this afternoon?
I'm doing all right. It's no news happening this week. I don't know how you're feeling your show.
Yeah, it's. I said that to Carl Cannon earlier this afternoon. There is going to be no challenge in the coming. I could just expand it out to years finding material, right?
Absolutely. I mean, it's resistance 2.0. Although this time the Trump administration is better staffed and they're. Their legal product thus far that we're seeing is much better lawyered.
Well, let's talk about this executive order. Look, they had to know, of course, that there was going to be a legal challenge and a judge stepped in and put a halt to this. Is there, let me just kind of cut to the chase quickly. This may be like the shortest interview ever. I don't think so. But is there a way to do this without a constitutional amendment?
Maybe is the answer.
Okay.
It's an open question. I mean, honestly, I've read some of the literature, but not all of it. And it's an open question whether the 14th Amendment, which says that all people born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States. So what does that jurisdiction clause mean? It's really unclear. And there are strong arguments on both sides. This will go to the Supreme Court, no question whatsoever. Today was the first ruling by a judge in Washington State, in Seattle, granted a temporary restraining order against it. But there are half a dozen other lawsuits. There are going to be rulings every which way. And I'm telling you, people ask me, and I say, all I can tell you is that there are viable arguments on both sides. It's certainly not open and shut. And I haven't yet made up my mind.
Yeah, you know, it is a tougher issue, I think, even for me, just doing the research and knowing a little bit about the background. If you wouldn't mind offering a little history here, because obviously the intention of this originally, I believe, and a lot of experts believe, was because of the 13th Amendment, because of slavery, right?
Well, it was a response to a post-Civil War response to Dred Scott, the idea that black people born in America weren't necessarily citizens. And this was correcting that. The thing is, in 1868, when the 14th Amendment was ratified, there was no concept of birth tourism, that is someone who just comes here to give birth, give their offspring citizenship, or illegal entry. You just didn't come across the southern border, take a ship from Europe and come across illegally. If you weren't lawfully entering, they just put you on the next ship back. That's why the question is an open one. Now, it's a little different with permanent residents, what we now call green card holders. There was a case from 1898, for example, that says that the kids of permanent residents do get citizenship. There are earlier cases trying to analogize things to the common law for rights of inheritance. Anyway, this is a very intellectual, deep debate, but subject to the jurisdiction thereof also doesn't just mean subject to criminal jurisdiction. That is, if you can be arrested and prosecuted for a crime, then you're – no, this is – citizenship jurisdiction, a different thing. And as I say, Mark, there are good arguments on both sides.
So what would the, if it gets to the Supreme, so what are the options that they would have? Could they just rule on the executive order? Could they actually make a ruling that indicates that the only way to, you know, to do something otherwise is to have a constitutional amendment? Is that something that they can declare or not?
Well, if they rule it unconstitutional, then by definition, the consequence of that is that you can only change this by constitutional amendment.
Okay.
Now, it could be a line drawing issue. That is, they could say we're not ruling on, temporary versus permanent, or, you know, people with long time student visas, work visas, what have you. We're just taking the order on its face, which deals just with birth tourism and illegal kids of illegal aliens. Without drawing the line wherever it might be. So it's not, you know, fully answering the question, but saying, yeah, this is okay, but you can't deny. Anyway, you get what I mean.
Yeah.
I think if I had to bet right now, I'd say that the court finds some way to block this simply because we've had this understanding for so long that, you know, the kind of the justices in the middle might not want to kind of disrupt this foundational idea of what it is to be American or something like that in a way that's different from, say, the overturning of Roe versus Wade, which was a modern invention just 50 years ago. So that's if I had to bet, but it's not a strong confidence in that prediction.
So the refresh my memory constitutionally here on the amendment. Is that something that has to be voted on by the states, or is it something that the House can do on its own with the Senate? I can't remember that.
It has to be two-thirds of both houses, of each house, and ratified by three-quarters of the states.
So both would have to happen.
Correct.
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting because I almost think that the issue, if you put this issue to the American people, I think they actually might say, yeah, we don't want birthright citizenship anymore. I don't know if I've seen recent polling, but the problem is it's just getting the process and getting it to the ballots. It's always seemed in the modern era that a constitutional amendment isn't really even possible.
Well, the other way to get a constitutional amendment is to have an Article 5 amendment convention. This has been tried most notably with the balanced budget amendment. The Equal Rights Amendment was in the news, although that was proposed by Congress. But if enough states, if two-thirds of the states propose this amendment, then it gets taken up. Then a limited, potentially limited convention arises to formulate it.
Would you expect that on the court challenges that the Supreme Court would rule relatively quickly, or is this something that could drag on here for a little while?
At the end of January. We're already at the end of January, and you know, the court ends in June. They can do things on an emergency basis. I mean, look at the TikTok case, right? It was ruled on by the D.C. Circuit, and what, 3 weeks later, it was ruled on by the Supreme Court?
Yeah.
So we'll see. It's going to be fast and furious for the next little while. Would the Supreme Court want to put it on its docket in time for a late June decision? I don't know.
A lot of questions still remaining. Ilya, always great to have you on. Thank you so much. I appreciate it. And we'll see where this takes us.
And make sure to read my book, Lawless, The Miseducation of America's Elites, just out last week.
Oh, I'm glad that you threw that in. So we've talked about the book. I knew it was coming out. So that's out last week.
Yep. It's been doing the rounds. And it's doing well so far. But every media hit, I press refresh on Amazon. And it does a little bump. So this is the story of the failure and the illiberal takeover of legal education.
All right, do a little bit more of a pitch here because I have a couple minutes. So tell us more about the book because I forgot some of the specifics. No, we got to get the word out. I'm happy to help because I want people to know about this.
Great. If you have the time, I can talk your ear off about it. It builds on my so-called lived experience with Georgetown when I was investigated.
Oh, yeah.
And nearly fired for a tweet. Coming up on 3 years ago now of that tweet. To look at the various institutional failures, specifically in legal education, as part of our broader crisis of higher ed. And these are failures of ideology. These are failures of bureaucracy, such that now most universities have more non-teaching administrators than faculty, and a failure of leadership, where deans and presidents and provosts, you know, they're generally not woke radicals. They're careerist bureaucrats, and they've been reading their cost-benefit incentives in a way that harms the traditional core mission of any institution of higher education, of open inquiry and academic freedom, civil discourse, in a law school context, understanding and upholding the rule of law. So we're in a dangerous place because, you know, lawyers are the gatekeepers of our political and legal institutions, and if they consider all of those institutions to be illegitimate, well, then the republic crumbles.
First of all, I can't believe that's been 3 years because we talked about it a lot when it happened. Are you at all optimistic that the proverbial worm has turned just a little bit on this issue?
Well, clearly it's turned a little bit. And in society writ large, we're past peak woke. Doesn't mean that we can rest on our laurels, but there's clearly a pushback, the pendulum, the swinging back. Most recently with the slew of anti-DEI executive orders and things like that. In higher education, there's going to be more pressure now from the federal government, but the culture is such, and the critical mass on the, higher ed is divided between the left and the far left. So they have to be brought kicking and screaming due to these external pressures from employers, legislatures, federal investigations and all the rest of it. I'm less pessimistic than I was 3 years ago. Let me just put it that way.
So when you say, though, some of the leadership is maybe the leadership of the institutions aren't exactly as woke as the professors, but they're bureaucrats and they don't really care to fix anything. Is that part of that point?
That is part of the point. And it's not necessarily as woke as the professors. And sometimes it's as woke as the bureaucrats, who tend to be even more radical and not steeped in norms of academic inquiry and things like that. And look, the good thing is that the more savvy of the leaders, typically at the more so-called elite places, they recognize that if their institutions are getting a big black eye, they got to change something. You know, the dean of Yale Law School, Heather Durkin, wants to be an Ivy League president someday, and there have been scandal upon scandal that I document in my book, Lawless. And so she said, okay, I got to right this ship, change some policies, hired a very good professor who's on the right, Keith Whittington, a junior professor who clerked for Alito. So she's trying to rehabilitate. That gives me some optimism that at least for some institutions, this is not across the board. You know, Harvard isn't magically fixed just by having Claudine Gay resign. It'll take sustained pressure to get these reforms.
Well, and I wanted to get your thoughts on that. I'm glad you brought this up at the end. And I mentioned this to Carl Cannon in the last hour. I don't want to waste the audience's time or your time with the whole story. I can share it with you another time. But I have this little interesting developing relationship with the dean of my alma mater, the University of Missouri Journalism School. His name is David Kirpius. He's invited me to come in and tour the school. I haven't been in a little while, and to go to a basketball game in a few weeks. And there was an indication from the dean that he is interested in what even Carl kind of wrote about in the last couple of days, viewpoint diversity, because one of my criticisms has been, hey, there is no viewpoint diversity. You got all this diversity in these newsrooms, supposedly, but there is no, as you know, viewpoint diversity. So I'll keep you posted on that, because I'm a little, curious about where those conversations might take us. And I'll have to take him at his word right now that he's kind of interested in those things.
All right. Well, yeah, keep me posted.
I will. Hey, thank you. Have a great weekend. Thank you, Ilya. We'll talk soon.
So it's a new year, 2025, and you're thinking, how am I going to make this year different? How am I going to build something for myself? But where do I start? Shopify is how you're going to make it happen, and here's how. Shopify makes it simple to create your brand, open for business, and get your first sale. The best time to start your new business is right now. Get your store up and running easily with thousands of customizable templates, no coding or design skills required. All you need to do is drag and drop. Their powerful social media tools let you connect all your channels and create shoppable posts and help you sell everywhere people scroll. What happens if you don't act now? Will you regret it? What if someone beats you to the idea? Don't kick yourself when you hear this again in a year because you didn't do anything now. With Shopify, your first sale is closer than you think. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/odysseypodcast, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/odysseypodcast to start selling with Shopify today. Shopify.com/odysseypodcast.
Audio cut of the day. I have a lot to choose from. It's been a very, very interesting day politically. And then, of course, we got the fires out west. We're going to talk about that here. It's been a little tricky today.
Let's start cutting line this way. And then we're going to take hose to you.
Yeah, a couple of different fires have really been challenging for these crews, but they've done a pretty good job. In the meantime, the president's going out there tomorrow. Will he offer relief?
I don't think we should give California anything until they let water flow down into their...
It's from the north to the south.
This is a political thing. I don't know what it is.
I went home last night and I started watching the coverage on Fox 11 and some of the stations out there. I've been listening to KNX in Los Angeles as well. And our friend Brian Ping is back with us from KNX, who is a St. Louis native. I have not tracked this for the past 4 hours being on the air and getting ready for the show. So I don't know where you are, but it didn't look very good earlier this morning, Brian.
No, it didn't look great, but thankfully it does not look like the fire is spreading too much more to a point where it's at least threatening the homes or structures. We're talking about the Hughes Fire here, the one we talked about yesterday up in Castaic, which is the northern mountains way north of Los Angeles. There's still a town of 20,000 there, but there is a lake between the fire and the town, and that is acting as kind of a nice block. We did see really towering flames last night, 10 to 30 feet is what I was told. But there's a good thing about that, though. If they're going straight up, it means they're not being pushed by the wind. If it's horizontal and you got flying embers going right in front of you, that's when you worry about a major spread. But if the flames and smoke is allowed to go straight up, that just means it's, you know, burning through fresh fuel, if anything. And it only gained about 1,000 acres since about around sunset last night.
But then you had this fire that really started burning out of control near Oxnard. It looked like it was like northeast of Oxnard in Ventura County. So what's the status of that?
Yeah, so far it's just, you know, monitoring and maintaining. Right now the winds are not too extreme. There are still red flag conditions, and there are some evacuations in the area. But so far it has not reached a level that we can be too worried about. But, you know, these next 36 hours are critical as we await possible rain to come in on Saturday.
You know, Sue and I were wondering, we still, from, you know, following this from afar, Brian, it's a little tough sometimes to gauge when you say so much contained, 12%, 15% contained. That's confusing to us. Can you put that into a little bit of perspective?
Yeah, it's about laying containment lines. And sometimes if that containment number is not progressing rapidly, doesn't necessarily mean they're not making progress on the fire itself, because, you know, the Palisades fire covered such a wide area that, you know, they had to go in and make sure that the fires and the spot fires inside that fire zone weren't acting up. So that was the main priority, is protecting certain areas within the fire zones, you know, before they concentrate on getting containment lines around, because it's not necessarily, you know, threatening life and property at some of its edges. So it's up to 24% containment on this new fire, the Hughes fire, the one that erupted yesterday. And that is a much more rapid containment than we saw with the Palisades fire. It was several days stuck at 0% before they were able to get more of a handle on that one.
But I also saw, like, is technically the Palisades fire totally contained at this point? Because I thought I saw that wasn't even totally contained.
No, they're still working on that. Right now, it's mostly maintenance inside, and they're not letting certain people back because you know, hazmat situations in there and broken gas lines and things of that nature. But as far as an active fire, it's the threat of it is mostly over. This last round of Santa Ana's that's blowing through today and tomorrow, it's kind of bypassing the Palisade zone. It's got to hit it just right. But thankfully, it's been spared. So it gets down to kind of a technicality almost.
Yeah.
You know, they can't completely declare it, 100%, but it's pretty academic at this point. It's just a matter of management and maintenance and mitigation before they get everybody back in there.
And of course, one of the things I was watching earlier on some of the coverage from Los Angeles, and Brian, I'm sure KNX has to cover this, the boneheads that are trying to sneak into these neighborhoods and then police have to chase after them and try to get people into captivity. It never ends, does it?
Yeah, and that's another unfortunate part of this whole story. And you know, we have a new district attorney who wants to make a splash. He definitely wants to show everyone who's boss, and has been, you know, getting out in the public eye and announcing arrests and charges for people that you know, violate these curfews. They had to put a curfew up from 6 p.m. to 6 a.m. every night to prevent against this very type of thing. And it's people who might loot, people who are impersonating firefighters for whatever reason to get in there.
Unbelievable.
But, you know, it's just a whole, it's a whole deal. Anytime you have a disaster in the scale, unfortunately, people are going to try and take advantage.
And what's the latest on the rain forecast?
Looks like we could get some rain as early as Saturday afternoon. Saturday night into Sunday is going to be the main event, so to speak. And looking at possibly a half inch to an inch of rain in places, a lot of mountain snow. So, yeah, we want it and we need it. But there is such a thing as too much of a good thing here, because if it comes down too hard for too long, those burn scars, the areas that where, you know, timber and brush have been knocked to the ground, they'll slide right down. It just needs a good push from some rain, from some running water. And that causes a whole other host of problems. So it's, you know, we're waiting for that other shoe to drop whenever we get fires in mountain areas in the winter before rains come.
Hey, Brian, it's Sue. I'm just wondering, we look at all this footage of just charred everything. And have they started talking about how they're going to handle this rebuilding? I mean, there has to be such demand for every resource, every builder.
Yeah.
I have a hard time comprehending how that's going to happen.
I'm with you, Sue.
Yeah, it is going to be an enormous task. But I actually spoke with a city planner in Santa Rosa, which is up in the Bay Area. They had a fire about 6 or 7 years ago, and they were getting some attention down here because it only took them about 3 years to rebuild 80% of the homes that were destroyed then. And he said a big part of that was just cutting a lot of red tape and, you know, right, a lot of jurisdictional hassles and headaches, get everyone on the same page. And he says, it is a daunting task. It might be a little more complicated down where we are, but you'd be surprised when it comes to the rebuilding stage, when the human element comes together and the will to do that. And I think we've seen some of the early signs of that.
But, right. But that
it's just going to be an enormous task. And we're talking about homes that, you know, were in the $3-5 million range in the Palisades. So it will restore, you know, some of that character. I mean, the land is always going to be prime, but how's it going to look differently? That's a big question.
So, you know, that also begs the question, well, wait a second, if these aren't required, these, you know, red tape, why do you need them at all? And I know that's something that's going to be discovered, or at least discussed rather, between Gavin Newsom and President Trump. And what's the preview that you're offering for that trip? That's going to happen tomorrow. Is that true? And are they going to meet? Do we know?
Yeah, it looks like there's continued back and forth about that. I don't think it's been nailed down and finalized just yet. But yeah, Mark, you did bring up an interesting point there about, well, you know, if they could just let down the gates of these regulations, why are they there in the first place? You know, Mark, you may be familiar with stories about the California Coastal Commission. They can be rather notorious for throwing up a lot of regulatory hurdles for what can and what can't go in certain areas. And, you know, Governor Newsom announced in the immediate wake of the fires that he will lower some of the regulations, and that got a lot of people saying, well, why were they even there to begin with? So yeah. that will be kind of a legacy of these fires too. It's just like, how much do we really need here? These fires are going to happen more often. And when we find ourselves in this situation again, really, what's the use of it?
Well, Brian Ping, St. Louis native, let me make you feel a little bit better. I know it's been stressful out there. When I wake up and when Sue gets up in the morning to do traffic for the morning show, it's going to be 8 degrees here.
I'm looking at these stories of snow way down south and all the cold over there, and I do wonder if it's all interrelated, because the jet stream, I'm not a meteorologist, but you got to think that it all works in concert. You know, there's an imbalance of all the water that's going to other places and that extreme cold. Like, you guys might get blocked from warm weather, we get blocked from all the rain. We just need it to end for you guys and for us. You need some warmer weather there. We need some rain. Let's get on with it already.
Well, that's true. And then, you know, I mentioned this story earlier too, which this is maybe a little bit connected from what you're just talking about. Did you hear about the flight from Vegas to London where they topped out at like basically a Mach 1.2, where an F-35 tops out at a Mach, you know, 1.6. The damn thing was going like 814 miles an hour because of the jet stream.
I did. That's incredible. It really, can you imagine flying the opposite direction?
Well,
you got to be like how many hours late because of that? Yeah, I don't want to be that.
You're bumping around like crazy. All right, Brian Ping.
I could have flown from there to St. Louis in about an hour and a half. Would have been great.
Right. All right, listen, we'll stay safe out there. We appreciate all the help, and have a great weekend.
All right, thank you, Mark. Thanks, guys.
It's realistically a situation where I hope I don't have to talk to him tomorrow, because that's actually good news, right?
Right.
It really, these crews are going to get their they're due eventually when all this stress is gone. But I'm telling you, for those people who haven't watched something in the last 24 hours in particular with the Hughes fire and with the one in Ventura County, you would have just thought that these were just going to run up and down these hills and take more communities out. But they've created these fire lines. They've used the pink retardant, which, you know, St. Louis is contributing. They've really used water because they've had water, which is something I guess they didn't have 2 weeks ago, but it really has been impressive. But these firefighting crews, they're like 12 on, 12 off, which has got to be just exhausting them right now. Hey, one story before I get to audio cut of the day. Sue, you and I talked about this off the air. We haven't addressed it. We'll talk about it on the roundtable tomorrow, but there was a story in the Post today about the developer of the Armory, and this happened, when was it, in the fall, where we realized that the Armory was closing down?
Yeah, I think that's right.
So the bankruptcy filing from the leader of Green Street Real Estate Ventures, I guess, reveals more than $400 million in debt. You could build a baseball stadium for that. Well, not anymore. You got to pay $1 billion. But you used to be able to build a football or baseball stadium for $400 million.
Yeah, and obviously they have other projects besides the Armory.
Well, that's a good point.
And,
right.
But that is so much money. And then I guess personally, one of the guys on there had a lot of money on personal credit cards. I mean, it's just a mess.
So there's been a bunch of lawsuits. The principal, Kevin Morrell, I guess, filed for Chapter 7 in the Eastern District, and you're going to have a trustee that liquidates his shares of the Green Street entities to pay the creditors if they can pay him anything. He had $5.5 million in assets with $432.2 million in debt. I'm not really good at math when it comes to income to debt ratio, but I think that's a little off balance, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, that's right.
63 creditors. It lists personal finance details like $90,000 in credit card debt, $48,000 in monthly expenses, $5,100 for entertainment each month. So here's the thing that is interesting. There's a guy that's quoted by the name of Phil Hulsey. H-U-L-S-E. He's the founder of Green Street. He says Morrell's bankruptcy will not affect the company or its business relationships, and he has no intention of filing for bankruptcy. We intend to be here for the long haul. What does that mean for St. Louis? And then, you know, in the following line where the guy is quoted as saying, we intend to be here for the long haul, the line in the paper is Green Street's fortunes crumbled in just a few years because, look, they were doing some of the things in the Grove and in other parts of the city. They went into St. Louis County with projects and elsewhere in the Midwest. They were doing apartments and hotels, town center, you know, some of this planning that's going on. They opened the Armory in 2022. They built it as the biggest bar in St. Louis. The pandemic hit. So that didn't help, right? So that disrupted, fair enough. That was a big issue. But they laid off the employees. They owed $1.2 million in real estate taxes across the county and the city. And then you had lawsuits and all these other things. And now We see the bankruptcy filing. We know that $61.2 million from the Bank of Washington for Green Street's new apartments. What happens to the Bank of Washington? How much do they get back in that, right?
Yeah, I don't know.
Did they get $0.2 million out of $61.2
million? Yikes.
$59.5 million from real estate investment firm Acre Originator from Atlanta for the Terra at the Grove apartment project. So they owe $59.5 million for that. $35 million from Wells Fargo Commercial Mortgage in 2019. You know, when you think about this, Sue, I pay my credit card bills, okay? Mm-hmm. I have a mortgage as well that I pay. Man, how much more are we all paying to Wells Fargo and these other banks because of guy and the rest that can't pay their bills? That would be one question I would have, right?
Yes, it would. And who approved all these loans?
Let's see here. I want to see if it says banks comprise the majority of the creditors.
Uh-huh.
One is Festus-based Midwest Regional Bank. That's a local bank, right?
It is.
They have 11 separate claims totaling $20 million, including $1.3 million that it loaned a Green Street company last year for a different industrial project in North St. Louis. But it says there are 17 companies and individuals whose claims are not backed by collateral, making the likelihood of repayment slim. Yeah, that would make sense, right?
If that's just a bad loan, that's not a good business decision.
But then what happens to because I thought when this all happened with the Armory, maybe it was this guy that's bankrupt. He would say, oh, we're going to move on. This is going to open. But it doesn't seem like the Armory is coming back, is it?
I can't imagine with all that.
Well, so then what happens to that real estate? Did they get a good deal like the AT&T building where it sold for $300 million and somebody picked it up for $3 million? Phew. I'd love to know what's going to happen there. We'll talk about it on the roundtable tomorrow. Audio cut of the day coming up next. You know, when I do the bumper music, I don't think I ever pull a live version of a song, but this is one of my favorite Billy Joel songs that literally has a better version on a live album. It's called Summer Highland Falls. He did a record called Songs in the Attic, live record in the 70s that had, you know, some of the earlier Captain Jack's on
some
really
cool.
This is great.
These are not the best of times, but they're the only times I've ever known.
So I started to pull this from the, the regular studio recording, and I just love the live version so much.
Time for meditation in cathedrals of our own.
All right, so you'll hear a little bit more of that on the back half when we wrap the show, but I have to do this.
Stand by. Playback ready.
Now, the audio cut of the day.
I have a few for you here as we wrap up on a Thursday. This is J.D. Vance, the new vice president, visiting the Oval Office for literally the first time. Mike Johnson giving him a tour.
Wow. This is J.D. Vance's first time to step into the Oval Office.
Wow.
It's incredible.
This is incredible.
That was awesome. Very inspirational. And then you have this story from Bill Malusian, which is not very awesome. And, you know, it indicates why Tom Homan and ICE, and we have to crack down on people who shouldn't be here. This is a guy that they caught who is declaring his thanks to Barack Obama and Joe Biden.
I'm not going back to Haiti.
One of those threats is this illegal alien from Haiti.
ICE says he's a gang member with 17 criminal convictions in recent years.
So, you feel me? Yo, Biden forever, bro. Thank Obama for everything that he did for me, bro.
ICE Boston quickly takes down its next targets, including this illegal alien from Brazil who has an Interpol red notice for armed robbery. This Salvadoran illegal alien charged locally with rape and released by a sanctuary jurisdiction.
Señor, ¿cómo se llama?
And this Dominican illegal alien charged with assault with a deadly weapon and heroin trafficking. Officers also arrested this Guatemalan MS-13 gang member facing gun charges. ICE says he was released from local custody just the day before. Their detainer request was ignored because of sanctuary policies. And in a sign of shifting priorities with the new Trump administration, this man, who was in the same apartment as the target, was also arrested after ICE determined he's also in the U.S. illegally. This is what ICE calls collateral.
Yeah, so really good reporting. And let me juxtapose that Bill Malusian on Fox focusing on raids, actually achieving things that President Trump said he was going to do, with Tom Homan on CNN with Dana Bash. Dana, very concerned, not about the American people and the American taxpayers, but with the migrants and the people who aren't here legally.
But you are also saying that those who are undocumented in the U.S., also who don't have criminal records, people who are working in their communities, maybe even have spouses who are American citizens, they could be swept up with ICE today as well?
What I'm telling you is when we go find our priority target, which is a criminal alien, if he's with others in the United States illegally, we're going to take enforcement action against him. We're going to force the immigration law.
Why wouldn't you? She seemed very confused by the fact that if you would go, let's say that you're arresting someone for assault and they have a kilo of cocaine in the apartment, there's other people, you would arrest the people with the kilo of cocaine, I believe, right? So they are also breaking the law. Dana, see, this is the challenge of the legacy media, Sue, and I think you know this, we've chronicled it. They just simply, and this is the progressives as well, hopefully not all Democrats, but I sometimes wonder, they simply cannot distinguish between legal and illegal immigration. It's unbelievable.
I mean,
how hard is it?
It's not.
It's not that hard at all. But they keep going back to the same thing over and over and over again and making these ridiculous claims. But we will talk about all of this. Tomorrow, it's a Friday, a Reardon Roundtable. I missed last week because I was out in the desert. Jane will be here. Former Senator John Lamping. I actually haven't caught up with John for a while. And John Gaskin will also be on the panel. He's a lobbyist in Jeff City. Paul Hall with Entertainment Talk at 4:25. Kusumana will be here. We'll take you into the weekend. Not only talking some football with Frank, but with Alex Gold from Kansas City, who's one of our favorite people over there. I've talked to Alex quite a bit about the sports wagering amendment, and he's a Chiefs expert, so we'll talk about the Chiefs and the Bills. And then our friend Tim Summer tomorrow night. He wrote a great piece that was in the New York Times about aging roadies and guitar techs, and I love that, so we'll talk a little music tomorrow night. Sue, have a great night.
You too.
We'll talk tomorrow at 3.
Get more at 971talk.com.